Thank you very much, Bo Rothstein and Marcus Tannenberg. Very, very excellent presentation, and I think you kept time very well as well. Very thought-provoking, and I think that a lot of us are interested in the Big Bang. Let's get back to that a bit later. We have asked Alina Mundi-Pipiri to comment on the main topics of the report. And I'd like to ask her to come up here on stage. You can go down, yes. And Alina, she's a professor in democracy studies at the Hertie School of Governance. And I think you're a very good person to comment on these issues. You have a long record of research and a great interest in state building, institutional transformation, and governance issues. And in your last book, you also discussed these issues thoroughly. The Quest for Good Governance, How Societies Develop Control of Corruption. So, very welcome, Alina. You're also chairing a number of interesting projects. We might hear something more about that today. One of them is the European Center for Anti-Corruption and State Building. And you also act as an advisor to many donors. So now we've heard about what and so what. And now we get to now what. Please, Alina.
Thank you. Although I don't use this, I just use this place. Okay, so my name is Alina. My research center is in Berlin. And you know how they say. So I'm Alina. I am studying virtuous circles. But before studying virtuous circles, I studied vicious circles for many, many years. I'm trying to move into virtuous circles for the past 2-3 years. So in other words, I'm trying to move away from the area where you look at why things end up by not changing, and by reproducing particular patterns, to the area where you understand why you have discontinuity and out of a sudden societies start to change. And as you can very well imagine, I am really missing cases to study, because all in all, we do not have more than 7 clear-cut cases that we all agreed upon. And in fact, I would say that undisputable, there are only 5 of countries which managed to improve governance significantly in the contemporary world in the last 30 years. Now, you've heard, and I fully endorse, the definition of governance as centered on this primacy of social allocation by Professor Rothstein and the Quality of Government Center. So what actually does it mean to change governance? How do we know if we succeed or if we fail? I think this is really like the central question to validate all our assumptions in the end of day. Can we measure what Bo is showing now, this passage from a particularistic distribution of public goods in a society to one which is based on equality, equal treatment, what he calls impartiality, and the primacy of ethical universalism? What would basically be equal, open access for everybody? Because let me make clear that this is what we try to do. The discussion, or the narrow discussion of corruption as an exception, has turned into this very broad discussion, and this is what we understand by institutions, and this is what economists like Danny Roderick claim that matters. But if we phrase it like this, we can realize that actually it's quite an enormous challenge in itself. But without solving this challenge, I fully agree with the authors of the report that development does not work. And also, I agree, since I'm among the people who gathered the evidence for this, that the only countries which made it are not countries which donor worked. So they're not really like big successes of recipes of the international community, but they're just individual successes, countries which, with some foreign help, I'll allude to this, managed to fulfill the change, but roughly in a more organic, domestically driven way and not as part of somebody else's project. So I think that what I'll do is that I'll just give you these three ideas on the report, and then I'll move into just stating, because we don't have time for more than that, but of course I'm happy to individually answer other questions afterwards, into the seven broad lessons coming out for the development community out of this particular approach that we've heard here today. I think the report is actually very strong on the diagnosis part, but I think it sort of stops when going into the full consequences of what this line of argument takes us into. So first important issue is if we accept this definition, and if we accept a mechanism which is based on collective action problems, well, of course, we eliminate a lot of aid which was ineffective and in our view plainly stupid, but it doesn't mean that the problem is easier to solve. Actually, collective action problems are the most difficult to solve. And this is why they do not succeed. So this is why I believe that it is so important to understand what have these very few countries which made it, how did they manage to solve these collective action problems, or why the collective action problem was actually less in these countries. And as a short way to look at this, I just suggest that you tap on YouTube and you find an earlier interview that I did this year with the leader of one of these most successful countries, which is Estonia. And I interviewed the Prime Minister of Estonia, Mart Laar, who had been twice a Prime Minister in the early 90s, on basically his anti-corruption record, on why has him, who never had like an explicit anti-corruption project, simply not endorsing, because he was the first person to do it, simply taking this kind of comprehensive approach that the report today spoke about, how did he manage to build this country which was equally corrupt as the rest of Soviet Union and which is really now on top of government and lots of other issues. It is really like the biggest success in the world. And you will see that he is perfectly aware of everything he done, critical of international community and the Washington consensus and the advice he gave. But in the same time, I can tell you that he succeeded in passing all his key legislation for progress by only one vote. He had appointed all his friends who had been dissidents in communist times in government. So he created an exact number of positions for all his friends, which was a very small government since they were a small group. Larger groups had been a bigger chance of being arrested by the police. And he had a minister of justice in the country which has like the most advanced reform of justice in the world, a person who didn't have a law degree and who had actually been a prisoner in a common law prisoner in Soviet times. Of course, you remember that, they were putting people in jail for criminal offenses who were de facto political prisoner, and this was the case of Lars Justice Minister. But what I mean to tell you is that if you look at this small virtuous group of people with clear ideas on how governments should work, who wanted to eliminate completely the over-regulation of Soviet times, considering it corrupt, and who promoted the best successful case of good governance, you will see that there is a tremendous amount of lessons which cannot be easily taught to other countries, because you cannot tell them, find this virtuous nationalist group. He was a professor of national identity, right? This is what he was studying. Find this group which actually equivalates good governance with patriotism, which perceives that for the existence of this tiny state, Estonia, it is essential that they are different from Soviet Union, right? And then do this exceptional mobilization, because you may, have a critical mass by only one vote. And then, in the end, and he had two terms. In his first term, he reduced opportunities for corruption drastically by his very liberal approach. He simply pulled out discretionary regulation from every area. And in his second term, he did the e-government. And this was it. This was it. Trace Estonia in world governance indicators is doing better than anyone else. Now, why do I say, then, that is my second point on measurement. How do we know if we succeed or not? Why do I say that Estonia is top of class, and why don't I say the same things about Latvia, whoever? Why, for instance, I don't agree that Indonesia is an achiever, although I agree that Indonesia made progress? Because the only way of qualifying a country as an achiever is if achievement is sustainable. So, in other words, we have developed methodology now. I will show it to you, actually. We have developed methodology. So here we show how on the basis of roughly procurement data, wherever you can get it, we can come up with a clear measure, a national measure, of how many public contracts per country are given in a particular way versus a universal way. This instrument, which we now show for only 7 countries, but which can be done in roughly any country for which you can gather data, allows you to trace progress and presumes that you start in a very corrupt country from a 100% particularistic allocation. You can see who gets the contract. I mean, this person got the contract because he is the brother-in-law of the prime minister. This person got the contract because he's in the main government party and, therefore, so forth. And you can start from 100% particularistic allocation, and you can have a target that in 10, 15 years, you arrive to, 100% normal, which is random allocation. So instruments exist, and I only consider a country a success when you move into a majority of allocations which are no longer particularistic. So even if you move from, let's say, 20% clean contracts to 30% clean contracts, there is absolutely no guarantee. You need to arrive to a majority of clean transactions on behalf of government and to have it for a sufficient number of years for this norm to take root. Then you can consider a country an achiever, and this is why we have so few achievers, which are Chile, Uruguay, Costa Rica, South Korea, Taiwan, and Estonia. And I am promoting Georgia as a partial achiever, but I am aware that they're not there yet. And we have also discarded other countries which in World Bank rankings do good, like Botswana and Qatar, and I can explain later why we do not consider that those countries have arrived at ethical universalism. Finally, the third crucial point for policy, which is explicitly stated in this report, but I believe not fully solved, is the matter of causality. We have to differentiate very well the means from the ends. And we are plagued by endogeneity problems in governance research. For instance, and I will deal with this only because this is the most controversial issues. Merit-based systems are central to the way a society works. Even in the Kyogu survey, for instance, they've done a survey of 88,000 respondents in 20-something European countries. You see that only in Northern Europe you have a majority of people which agree that merit and not connections are the number one mechanism of success in life. But you would be surprised, but over 30% of people, even in these countries, do not agree with this. Then if you look at Mediterranean countries, you will find that the population is basically split. Half believe that it is merit, but half believe that connections, other particular links that you might have in life, is what explains success, both in public and private sector. And it's a remarkable correlation between public and private sector, showing that this is an ingrained social mechanism. And finally, in the new member countries, you actually see that it is a majority which believes that it is not success, that it is not merit which explains success. A majority believes that your particular position in life, the connections that you have, like in Jane Austen novels, connections are everything, explain how far in life you get and not the rest. And this is definitely quite daunting. So let me move into the very short 7 lessons now which come out of this, because I think that once we measure something and once we understand, we are on a good track. But impressive challenges remain. So challenge number one, I would say, lesson number one is that donors should not take rule of law for granted and should not multiply this gap between formal and informal institutions by adding more and more laws. By now, we have enough evidence that the more laws you have on party financing, the more laws you have roughly into everything, we only confirm the old Roman saying, which says that most corrupt countries have the most laws, right? So for our approach to work, rule of law is like the preliminary step. In other words, politically, nobody should be above the law in a country. Now, this is a very political thing. If we cannot achieve this, none of this judicial repressive approach should be pursued, because we basically give very strong tools, which are these anti-corruption tools, the agencies or whoever, to whoever is in government to use against opponents. And this, I think, we increase the democratization problem. The second lesson is that Donors should not contribute to increasing opportunities for corruption. So I'm coming to the principle that Michael Johnson announced, which said primarily do not do harm first before thinking of doing good. Right? We unwillingly increase opportunities for corruption, particularly by material resources, by bringing aid that we, you know, the same nice saying of Mr. Varoufakis, who said, I mean, you tell us to pay the debts, but for many years, the EU funds for Greece have only contributed to bringing new money into local clientelism and giving more power to local elites. We have evidence, unfortunately, that this is true. Third is that do not depress demand for good governance. Do not create Samaritan dilemmas. You would be surprised, but they also exist in anti-corruption. So yes, we have evidence that it matters a lot. Demand matters a lot in anti-corruption. There's normative constraints imposed by societies. But you have to think first who are the local groups who want to change the rules of the game. As a donor, you should identify them and try to help them. Do not substitute themselves to them, because then they will simply not appear anymore. If you lead, you know, WikiLeaks telegrams, you'll find out that in some countries, the American embassy is creating the whole anti-corruption. You know, they call the 3-4 NGOs in town, and they say, okay, let's start a big anti-corruption coalition. You'd be surprised, but this will actually have a depressive effect on a real anti-corruption coalition which may appear in that society. It doesn't work this way. So first find the domestic agents and then help them. Do not create them. Fourth, go comprehensively. This, I think, is coming out very good on these reports. Go comprehensively. Control of corruption is an equilibrium. Unless you touch more elements than one, there is absolutely no way to be any effect. I speak a lot about this in my Cambridge book, so I won't spend more time now. Fifth, you have to come up with designs which cuts through state and society. The statistical evidence that we have uncovered in the last year, I mean, we also try to progress, because in early years, 3-4 years ago, when we started to do this evidence-based work in anti-corruption, we only found that nothing works. And, you know, this was good because it was evidence, but it was also depressing. So we have now moved on from studying isolated tools like anti-corruption agencies or this type of legislation into testing more complicated contexts. And what seems to come out is that there are interactions which work. In other words, fiscal transparency works if you have a very active civil society enforcing fiscal transparency. E-government works if there is sufficient demand in society for e-services. In other words, you find enough users to use this tool. So in other words, you have to support both sides. You have to support the government to offer more as e-government, but you also have to support infrastructurally the country to create this group of demanding citizens, people who want good governance, who would use. And this goes on and on. I mean, we now have evidence that financial disclosures, if you study them in isolation, don't work. But if you financial disclosures together with press freedom, they work. And this is the area where we built up more and more evidence, and we try to come up with what are virtuous combinations rather than isolated tools, because we know that no isolated tools work in this very difficult context, simply because lots of things are missing, too many things are missing. You have to build up a whole equilibrium, not just one thing. So finally, I would say that trace progress. I already told you that we can do this. This would be number 6 lesson. To know where you are all the time. Progress can be traced. We now have indicators. We know how to build this. Any project that you have can measure impact and to see if your intervention really helps or it's simply useless. And finally, good governance as a component. This also, I think, comes out nicely out of this report. Good governance should be a component of everything people do in development. Just think if this vicious, non-meritocratic way of which a country is organized is going to be affected by the way you distribute your aid, rather than attacking corruption directly, because you cannot isolate it to attack it. This is our main wisdom. Thank you.